Okay, so I'll have office hours today again, and homework number three is due, due tomorrow at 5 o'clock. Homework number three went there somewhere on, when was it, Friday? I posted it. And is that quick enough for some people? Some people were asking for this to be introduced in a timely manner. And so you are having more than half a week to do the homework problems. What else? People are sort of like asking me how to study for the course. Well, coming to lectures, doing the homework, and then as the exam is approaching, looking at the old exams is a good way of approaching this, okay? There's all these old exams sitting there. Please start working them. Some of them actually resemble homework problems simply because, as we promised, some homework problems end up being exam problems. So that's how you should approach. Okay, so we haven't lost any time. We finished first week's materials in 1 week. We are exactly where we want to be. A quick summary. One of the things that we learned last week was that static fields are curl-free. Okay, curl of E is equal to zero for static fields. This is not the case for dynamic fields. And when curl of E is equal to zero, then you can express these electric fields, static electric fields, as negative the gradient of a potential function V of x, y, z. This is the so-called electrostatic potential, or even voltage. As a concept that comes back to you from your circuit forces. Okay, so minus the grad V gives you the electric field. And how do you go from the electric field to the potential? You do a line integration. And with static fields, this line integration is independent of the path that you take between two points. Okay, you typically integrate from a point that you designate to be the ground to which you associate, with which you associate zero potential, to a different location, and whatever number you end up, whatever scalar you end up there, is the potential there with respect to the ground that you started with. And you could have gone this way, or you could have gone this way between the same two endpoints. It didn't matter. And if this is the case, if this path and this path is giving you the same potential, then you can imagine very easily that if you went all the way around, first taking one path and then continuing in the inverse of the negative, the other path that you might have tried, you end up with full cancellation of the potential and you have a zero closed line integration. So this then implies that the very same static electric field, if it was line integrated going around some contour, and now I'm going to indicate that closed contour integral by putting a little circle here. This means that I'm considering a closed path, okay? And we can even give a name to that closed path, C. And I go around this closed path either clockwise or counterclockwise direction, and that has to do with the direction of little incremental vectors, dl, I take along this contour. So if I take my dl to be like this and a whole sequence of them, then I have one particular way of going around. And if I were to reverse the direction of this, I would get the same number but with the other sign, but if it is equal to zero, that doesn't matter. Any questions here? Now, it turns out that there is a strong relationship between this line integral and the curl that is what you encounter in your math course as Stokes theorem, okay? That Stokes theorem indicates the following. A closed contour integral of a vector field is going to equal, and there is a contour that is indicated. Now, that contour defines an area that connects that contour, okay? That area can be the flat area that you see on the blackboard, or it can be a more complicated area that sort of like bombs out. It's a convex or concave, came out of the blackboard, but it is always terminated at the periphery, this contour C. The shape doesn't matter, but there is an area. And that area itself can be broken into little patches, and with each patch we can associate normal vectors that have a magnitude that is equal to the infinitesimal area element. In other words, we can associate DSs associated with this surface that is bounded by contour C, and claim that this integral is in turn equal to now a surface integral over the surface S So here I'm indicating the surface that is bounded by contour C of the curl of electric field, which is a vector. Okay, and this is of course a scalar. To turn this into a scalar, it has to be dotted into something, and that something is ds. Okay, it turns out these two things are equal to one another, and this is Stokes' theorem. And this is sort of like analogous to divergence theorem. What was divergence theorem? We had the divergence of D integrated over a volume V that was enclosed by a surface S, and that on that surface S we have the D dot ds integration, and because that was a closed surface we put this. Okay, this was our Gauss's law in integral form. Because what is divergence of D? Divergence of D? Rho. Okay, and what is the volume integral of rho? Charge. Okay. So you clearly recognize here the integral form of Gauss's law with the right, with the left hand side, the way I put it down, corresponding to the charge enclosed. Okay, that is a physical interpretation of this equation. This is Gauss's law in integral form, but it also mathematically it is the so-called divergence theorem, right? And I should put here a closed surface here. There is a closed surface that encloses a volume, and there is this divergence related to the flux, and it is on the basis of this equation, so we said that divergence is flux per unit volume. This is divergence, this is flux, this is flux per unit volume, because we are multiplying with incremental volume. And is that making sense? I'm just imagining something that we saw last week. I'm asking you. Okay. I just need some feedback. So, just this integral, this divergence theorem, blows life into this operator divergence. The Stokes theorem that is written in this fashion blows a life into the curl. Okay, and of course, if the curl of E is equal to zero, you replace it with zero, the integral of zero is equal to zero, then you get that this integral is equal to zero. Okay, electrostatic fields have both the curl equal to zero and also the closed line integral equal to zero. They mean the same thing, okay? And we refer to such fields in with various names. One of is curl-free, the other based on this guy, which we say that it is a conservative field, okay? The conservative fields have the property that when you do a line integral, closed line integral, and come back, you add everything, but those things also cancel out, and you end up with a net sum that is equal to zero. And conservative field, well, that word conservative right there is, of course, being used because of conservation theorems that is associated with the conservative fields. Energy conservation is what we have in mind, but in general, this is the term that is used. Any questions here? So finally, just as divergence is flux per unit volume, in this limiting sense that we talk, from this equation, we see that the curl is circulation per unit area in a same limiting. So now I'm throwing you one more terminology, circulation. Okay, this line, closed line integral, people refer to as circulation. That is also a reasonable sort of a nomenclature. One last thing, okay, in talking about curls and Stokes' theorem and the corresponding line integral, we have to be a little bit specific about in which direction we go and how do we select the surface area element. Okay, the convention is, this is all true if we use our right hand rule in the following sense. We point our thumb in the direction that we are circulating around the contour, and then our fingers curl through the area and pierces it in some direction. You have to take your ds vectors to point in that direction and not the opposite direction. Okay. If you take the opposite ds, then you have to plug in an extra minus sign on one side of this equation in order to be consistent. Any questions here? Okay, so general conservative field written in a differential form or expressed in an integral form, related to that Stokes theorem, and Stokes theorem giving us a little bit more understanding of what it is, a curl is. Okay, so that's more or less some of the materials that I am referring to here. Okay, and maybe this picture sort of like tells us what circulation is about. I take a contour, close contour, break it into delta L elements, traverse it in some sense. At each of the elemental path increments, I have a dot multiplication with a vector, position vector, a displacement vector, and electric field. It is the sum of all things. As the size of those incrementals go to zero, that gives us the that gives us the circulation integral. Okay, and as shown there, the S is in right-handed. Right-hand rule is going to come in many different fashions and ways in this class. This is just one of them. Okay, you're going to use the right-hand. There is another one we use, right, which is in selecting our x, y, and z coordinate system in a consistent manner. That was also using our right hand, x cross y goes into z. So that's a second one I can remember right now. It's going to come up over and over again. Okay. So another one is going to be when we look at propagating waves, electric field and the H field are going to be oriented such that when you use your right hand and multiply, cross multiply E into H, E cross H is going to point with your thumb in the direction of energy propagation. That's going to be yet another version. So be sort of aware of every time you see a right hand rule being mentioned and just like try to sort of categorize and understand different versions of them. Any questions here? Okay. So I have an example here which I will skip. This is another example in which I painfully go around the loop doing line integrations, pay attention to the upper and lower integration limits, and show that because it's a conservative field, at the end I have a total circulation that is equal to zero. That there is nothing surprising there. I'm skipping that. Okay. Now, what we have over there now is replicating what I have just talked about here. And we see Stokes' theorem. Okay, and I have a little verification of Stokes' theorem here. Okay, we verified divergence theorem and also related divergence to the flux integral by considering the flux over a very small cubic volume and then shrunk that. Okay, we can do something like this related to curl. Okay, and circulation integrals. What do I do here? Let's look at what I call the verification of Stokes' theorem here. I do several steps and then deduce some stuff. Okay, first I look at a circulation integral. I say, hey, let's consider a circulation integral, but let's apply it to a small square path. Okay, instead of small cubic path volume, now a small square path. That's where that path is going to have delta y and delta z edges, therefore it's those are going to multiply one another into a surface area. That surface area can be the surface area that I use for normalization purposes. Let's just see how that works out. Okay, so I go around in the indicated arrow direction and write my circulation integral. Because I'm selecting small delta z and delta y, I end up using just the sample values at the center of each path and multiply. Integrations are being effectively replaced by products, and I have sums and differences. It all makes sense in a similar sort of a fashion. How do I do that? I have here, for instance, edge 1. I'm coming down, and that is going to... In that case, my direction is parallel to z, so therefore I'm going to pick up the z component when I do the dot multiplication, right? So ez is involved at edge number 1, okay? But then this electric field that I am following here is opposite to the z direction, okay? And because of that, ez is going to come up with a minus sign in front of it as it contributes to this integral. Is that making sense, Alex?
Yeah.
All right, so then that's going to be multiplied by dz because delta z, that's the edge of, that's the corresponding edge, okay? Then I go to the other side. This time I am going in z direction. My delta l is going in z direction. My e sub z by definition is pointing in z direction. So that product produces a positive contribution, and that is ez2 with a plus sign rather than a minus sign, multiplied by dz. So I have taken into account two of the edges. There are two more edges to take into account, and in this case they are going to be in y direction, right? In y direction I have edges 3 and 4 contributing, and minus sign here is associated with 4, and that is because while I am doing 4, okay, that direction is opposite to y direction, and that is why it is coming with a minus sign. And finally, my contribution number 3 comes with a positive sign. 2 minuses make positive, right? So all that seems to be okay after you have to pay attention to the signs, obviously. Is that making sense? You follow that. So I'm almost there, okay? One term is multiplied by delta z, the other one is by delta y. So I reorganize it a little bit. I said, why don't I pull out delta z, delta y as a common factor? If I do that, though, I have to take the first term divided by delta y so that this delta y cancels this delta y, and I'm in an even status in this line with respect to this line. And I also do the same thing here, but I have a division by delta z here. So this will cancel out. My EY term will have delta y. So that looks okay too, all right? So then I'm going to take, of course, the limit as delta z, delta y goes to 0, and that is going to give me my partial derivatives. I'm going to get partial derivatives here, dez dy, and I'm going to have minus the partial derivative dy dz. I'm going to get some sort of a thing like this as I'm taking the delta z and delta y into infinitesimals. And I will have the delta y, delta z be dy dz infinitesimal. So that is just evaluating one side of Stokes' theorem in some sense. Okay? All right. I am also saying here that the right-hand side of what? Okay, so this is this, okay? And if I take the del cross E independent of the previous line, I know what del cross E is through the del operator, right? If I take the del cross E, which is going to give me 3 components pointing in x direction, pointing in y direction, pointing in z direction, is coming from the determinant, okay? But if I then dot ds, that generic del cross E into ds, that is pointing in this direction, which is in the direction of x hat, for the particular geometry that we are working with, that is the incremental ds. It is dy dz pointing in x direction. That x dot multiplication will extract out. It will extract out the x component from the overall formula for the curl operator, and that is exactly what we see here, which of course resembles this. Okay, so that is the gist of the proof. Okay, so I'm able to then say, hey, what you see here is only this. Therefore, I'm able to make the next statement, which is dealing with only one component of the curl expression. I am able to say that when I take the curl and I dot multiply it with ds of one rectangle, one small square, I am able to see that that is equal to the line integral that we have calculated over only the edges of that one little square. This is not the full proof of Stokes' theorem, but we are almost there now. Okay? A bigger picture is for an arbitrary contour that is indicated by C. Whereas what we have done is we did it for one of these little things, okay? Now I can take my atom, the result that I have obtained, and I can just add many, many of those things, okay? I can take many, many of these things superposed, okay? And I can then claim that that is going to be given as the summation of this over all the rectangles that I have. And that is going to be the integral. That is going to be the area integral that I'm reaching. So that's more or less the idea here. Any questions here? So with respect to these squares, all the inner corners are going to be canceling one another out. Only the external one is going to survive. When I add up these atoms over all the possible rectangles that is sort of like covering the entire interior of that contour, all the inner contributions cancel out. And what I really end up then is just the summation where the contributions are coming only from the edges. So that is the sort of the overall proof or verification of Stokes' theorem that you must have seen earlier on in your math class. So that was just a reminder. We didn't go through the details, but that's the basic idea. Any questions here? So we did it for a small case, and we did it only for one component. We only worked it out for the component that is associated with the x component of the curl, okay? You would repeat this for all 3 components and combine together into a vector. Underlying the curl operator is therefore the Stokes theorem. And the interpretation that we have is then curl is circulation per unit area as that unit area is sort of like going away. Okay, so I want to then stop with that discussion and bring the discussion to another topic. The next topic is a brief discussion of boundary conditions. As we move into the world of full set of Maxwell's equation and dynamic Maxwell's equation, these boundary conditions are going to play a very important role. Right now, they are going to play a minor role, but it is important to build up our notions of boundary conditions. Right now, we are not dealing with magnetic fields, only with electric fields. There is the E field, there is the D field, and there is the charge density that we are dealing with in all our problems. In our static solutions that we looked at a few lectures ago, we saw that electric field sort of changes in a continuous manner with one exception. What was that exception? What was that? There is some configuration that makes a certain abrupt change in the field distribution. What was that one?
Boundaries.
Which boundary? What is happening at the boundary?
The origin.
No? Okay, so there is a singularity issue. Coulomb field has a singularity, right? So if you look at total static fields as summation of Coulomb fields in the microscopic sense, when you go to every point charge location, there is a singularity, okay? But what else did we do? We also worked out the field of an infinite line. With line that it was lots of dots, but then we went into the corresponding macroscopic field. Was there a singularity in that macroscopic field? There was. Again, things blew to infinity. Okay. So then the next level was the surface charge. And it was the surface charge that made a distinct change in the electric field. As you go from one side to the other side, what happened? Let's remind ourselves. If you have a rho sub s sitting here, and let's say this is positive, we imagine a whole distribution of plus charges, okay? And our intuition says that those plus charges are going to be producing fields that are sort of like pointing away from the surface in both directions, okay? So if this is our x direction, then we say that E is going to be by symmetry pointing in x direction, and it is going to be associated with an E sub x function. But this E sub s function is going to be oddly symmetric. It is symmetric because there is no reason to say the right side versus left side has any advantage. Because of that, there is symmetry. But it is an odd symmetry. E of minus x is equal to minus Ex. That was it, all right? But that is generating for us a discontinuity in electric field. Do we remember what is the formula for electric field here on both sides? It is rho sub s divided by 2 epsilon naught. Exactly, that's what we came up with. That epsilon naught is sticking around. As long as we are dealing with electric fields, that epsilon naught is always sticking around. Where is it coming from? Coulomb's law. It was there in Coulomb's law. All these calculations are deriving from Coulomb's law, but we got sort of like tired of those epsilon naughts and we defined instead
displacement.
Yeah, displacement was our shorthand. So what is the displacement then? Instead of rho sub s divided by 2 epsilon naught, we can say displacement, the corresponding displacement is displacement x of x is going to be rho sub s divided by 2. And that is for x greater than 0. Okay, and overall, it exhibits this symmetry. Odd symmetry. Now, this is indicating a jump. Okay, as we are approaching the surface where there is charge density from one side, we keep seeing the same D field until we cross that boundary. At that boundary, the field jumps by which amount? Twice that amount, because it is in one side, it has this magnitude and pointing in this direction. On the other side, it is pointing in the other direction, same magnitude, twice that amount. So this is something that I pointed out a few lectures ago, saying that one of the boundary condition issues is going to come just about this, okay? So how can we sort of like write this in a more systematic way? I'm going to write it as follows. Suppose that you have some surface, okay? And we care about the vector field just above that surface and just below that surface, okay? So I have one point there where I may be asking myself, what is the vector electric field there? What is the vector displacement field there? But I may simultaneously be asking the sort of corresponding question, but the other side of that same surface, and infinitesimally below the first one, but on the other side, what is the corresponding vectors? Okay? Well, let's give them names, okay? So I have a vector here, and I have a vector there. They are pointing as vectors because we are talking as vector quantities, but they are being evaluated on two sides of the surface, okay? So I'm going to give them different names. I'm going to say one of them is d plus, the other is d minus, okay? And then finally, we have a surface, and that surface has a unit normal vector direction, okay? That can be taken one direction or the other. I'm going to take it like this, okay? I'm taking it such that the unit vector n is pointing into the direction where I have labeled my field with d plus rather than d minus, just a convention. With these conventions, it works out that the boundary condition that we are going to be applying, not only in static problems, but also in dynamic problems, it works out, is the following. N, unit vector, dotted into the vector difference, d plus minus d minus. What is this taking? This is taking the difference of two vectors, but two vectors have, of course, even in their difference, x, y, and z components, three components. We are then, by dotting it, we are projecting it into the direction that is normal to the surface in question. Okay? So this is a specific boundary condition equation in that sense. N dot, the difference between the two displacements that are being measured at the same point but on two other sides of that surface. This is similar to 0 plus, 0 minus notations that we had in ECE 210, right? We had a unit step function that goes from 0 to unity. If it is evaluated at t equals 0 minus, it is 0. When it is evaluated at 0 plus, it has unity value. Whenever we have jumps, we use this sort of a notation, okay? So the pluses and minuses superscripts are referring to that, and this is equal to rho sub s. You grimaced here as if like you didn't follow what I was saying, or are you with me?
I'm sorry.
You are slightly confused.
I'm just looking at, so you're taking the dot product of it.
So every time I have a surface, okay, I ask myself the question, what if I go and look at the vector field? E, D, B, H, it doesn't matter, one of them. At this surface, but just above and just below. It may make a difference if they are not the same,
right.
Obviously. If they are the same, it doesn't make a difference. The question is, under what circumstances there may be a difference? The circumstance under which there is a difference is if that surface happens to be one that is containing a surface charge. That is the answer. Okay, so once again, I look at some surface, okay, and I say, I wonder what is the field here versus field there, okay? I'm going to call one of them d plus, the other d minus, okay? It doesn't matter which one which I call, but I have to be then consistent with my n hat, okay? Let's just turn it around and say, I said, hey, I'm going to choose this my n hat. I take the normal vector. Then I'm going to label this guy as d plus and label this d minus. These are two vectors. Maybe they are the same, okay? Actually, they are the same if rho sub s is equal to 0. If rho sub s is not equal to 0, then they are not the same. So the jump, the discontinuity that you experience is exactly the surface charge. Is that making sense now? I'm maybe making it mysterious sounding, but this is exactly what we found when we first solved using Gauss's pillbox the field of a surface charge, okay? Coming back to this picture, here we have a surface. This rho sub s is equal to, let's say, 2 coulombs per meter square. Again, what are the fields? What are the electric fields on both sides? Well, I know that electric fields are half of that divided by epsilon. 1 over epsilon naught, electric fields going this way and this way. Okay? Or I can say, let's work in terms of these. I have a D that is pointing in this direction, measured on the plus side, and I have a D that is also measured on the other side, also in the same direction. All right? One of them I'm calling D plus. Which one is the D plus one? That depends which direction is I'm taking for my unit vector. My unit vector, let us choose like this, which is the x direction. Then I'm calling this guy, say, D plus. And this guy?
D minus.
D minus. Okay? And what is, we know what D plus and D minus are, actually, because we have solved this problem. Tell me, what is D plus?
1.
1, and there is no division by epsilon not, but you have, but it's a vector. It needs a unit vector as well.
Coulombs per meter.
No, it needs a unit vector.
Oh,
you told me the right magnitude, but it needs a unit vector.
1 x hat?
Yes. 1 x hat, and say the units you were just about saying that.
Coulombs
per meter square. I better shut this light here. Okay? What about this other vector, d minus vector? Let's also construct that. It has the same magnitude, but it is pointing in? In the opposite direction. Okay, so help me with that. D minus is equal to that? Minus 1x with Coulombs per meter squared. Okay, so now, what if we were to implement this formula that I wrote here? Okay, let's see that it confirms. And it is going to confirm. What I need to do is, I take my n hat, which is x hat in this instance, and I don't multiply that into d plus minus d minus, okay? And this guy is 1x, this guy is minus 1x, okay? But there are two minus signs, what happens? And when you take all the dot products, x dot x gives you 1, and you have 1, minus minus 1, 2, that's what my rows are there. So that's it, okay? So what we already learned is now being encapsulated into a formula that one should keep in mind, okay? Although we have sort of like derived this for the specific case of an infinite surface charge in a static situation, this generalization turns out to be a robust one. It holds for all situations, even in time-varying situations, yes.
Shouldn't rho be coulombs per meter when you
no.
take the dot?
No.
Oh.
Unit vector. Now, what's the unit of a unit vector? How do you measure a unit vector? You take a vector and divide it by
magnitude.
So what happens to the original unit? Unit vector is unitless.
Yeah.
All right? Unit vector is unit because of a unit length, but it is unitless because it doesn't have any dimensions. It's a good point. All right? So it's Coulomb per meter squared. So you measure both rho and displacement with the same units, coulombs per meter squared. And that is the way you remember it, okay? Every time you cross a surface with a certain rho sub s, your d is going to jump by rho sub s. It will increase depending on direction. Yes?
I have a quick question about the negative. Should that be positive one since it's going in the direction of normal vector?
I know that. I know what d minus is, independent of this formula. I am determining it at this stage, based on our work from last week. Okay, I know that D is pointing in this direction, having the same magnitude as in this direction. So they are equal magnitudes. So the fact that it is pointing in different direction, I have to include somehow. Since their magnitudes are the same, I'm going to use opposite unit vector. That's how I do it. Okay, again, we think about these things in different ways. Okay. And this is why double negatives can be confusing. You know, if you change your criteria halfway through your thinking process in dealing with double negative situations, that is when you make sign mistakes. Okay? I'm doing it right. Okay? If I were not doing it right, I would not have this formula being validated. But the formula is being validated. Okay? So think through. Are you comfortable now?
Yeah.
Okay. It's just a vector that's pointing in the opposite direction. It has the same magnitude, okay? So D minus, in this particular case, because of our earlier work with Gauss's law, D minus is the vector that is equal to negative D plus, okay? If D plus is 1x, negative D plus is minus 1x. That's it. You have another question?
So if you were to point that in the other direction, then you have to label it as D plus.
So if I were to flip my n and decide to point in this direction, then I would be calling my d plus and d minus is the other way around. Yes. Your d plus, d minus designation always goes after your decision to call what to call n.
All right,
no.
Yeah. And your d plus is dependent upon which side. If your field is on the right and your d plus charge is on the right, then are you
No. There are actually, this is a physical problem. Don't get confused by the math. Look at it from a physical perspective. I'm starting with 2 coulombs per meter squared, okay? That's positive charge. That positive charge is going to be creating arrows going away from wherever those charges are. Okay, I know that in its pure elementary form in for a single point charge in Coulomb's law. Okay, but even in a surface, when I smear them into a surface, that fact doesn't change. I have a positive surface charge, and the fields are going to be pointing away from it on both sides.
Right.
Okay, then whether or not this guy is 1x hat or not. What's your name?
Brian.
Brian. Only depends on my agreement that this is the x direction. That's what I assume, all right? I've been assuming that this is my Cartesian coordinate system, x, y, z. Of course, if you, hey, buddy, this is minus x direction, you tell me, then I would put minus x there. But then, of course, d minus would get another minus sign. All right? Are we okay, or have I not addressed your question yet?
I think you can't take my question in which direction.
Okay, so let's go back to your question again.
What I was saying is I'm just making sure that with the arrows pointing the same way, the way that we learn vectors is that when the arrows are the same way, it's the same sign. Well, here, they're on two different sides of the point charge.
That's right.
Charge density.
Exactly. We are talking about two different vectors pointing in two opposite directions. A pair of directions which happen to be opposite. Yes.
We don't draw them on.
We do.
It just has magnitude negative 1 in that direction.
Ah, okay. So you're saying, what if we did it this way?
Yeah, would you have to call that D plus?
So that is physically the field that I'm dealing with.
Right.
But I'm generically calling the field that I'm dealing with, okay, the other direction. And because of that difference, there is a minus sign. It is like on a circuit diagram, you have a resistor that is current going through it. You select one direction as the current direction. Perhaps you're going to end up with a variable that is positive, perhaps that is variable that is negative. Okay? In this case, the actual current is analogous to the actual field, but the arrow direction of the current is analogous to the direction of D that I have drawn. Okay? That picture was actually irrelevant. When I am placing this generic picture on the blackboard, I have no idea where the D's are pointing. There are two D's, and they are pointing whatever direction that they are pointing. If they happen to be pointing in the same direction, their difference is of course going to be equal to zero. And that is going to be of course the case with rho sub s is equal to zero. Good point. Now, are we clear?
Yeah.
These D's were drawn arbitrarily. I have no idea what they are until I do the work. Okay. So in this case, Brian, I should have drawn it this way. You're right. I should have drawn it this way because I know it's physically that way. And I said, so then you could have said, hey, clearly this is minus x. Because I drew it the other way. That was my generic arrow. I think we are now in good understanding. Any other questions? Thanks. That's a good point. So anyway, that is the theorem. Okay, what about the tangential component? Tangential component turns out to be always the same for electric field under any conditions, whether there is surface charge, no surface charge, whatnot. There is always a equality of tangential electric fields in any situation. Okay, so let's now then write these two equations side by side, or one above the other, and burn it into our brains. Okay, one is n dot d plus minus d minus is equal to rho sub s. The second equation in the same n, this time not dotted, but crossed into the electric field on one side minus the electric field on the other side is always equal to zero. These are two boundary condition equations that's going to be with us all the way. I don't see any exception coming in. The only thing to associate with this picture is a surface, a unit vector to that surface that is selected, and once the unit vector is selected, then the designation of one vector with plus, the other vector with minus superscript. Okay. And the second equation, which goes n cross the electric field, isolates, instead of the normal component of the vector in question, the tangential component. That is what cross product always does. Okay, and it says that the tangential component of the electric field seen from both sides, they will always match. There is never going to be any occasion for the tangential electric field ever to jump. Yes?
Second equation only holds for electrostatic?
both of these equations are good forever. Electrostatic, magnetostatic, dynamic, everything. In fact, let me jump ahead, fast forward maybe several weeks, and write something on the blackboard that has mnemonic value. What is mnemonic? You remember it when you see it. That kind of a value. Yeah.
So it applies to magnetic fields, not just electric fields?
No. Right now, we have only electric fields because we are only talking about electric fields. But there are counterpart equations for magnetic fields as well. Okay? That is going to come. And this is what I'm going to put down on the blackboard for mnemonic purposes. Okay? There are Maxwell's equations that describe many things. Maxwell's equations describe electromagnetic waves. But in their reduced form, they also describe static electric fields. In their reduced form, they also represent static magnetic fields. All these three things are embedded in Maxwell's equations. We've been spending time electrostatics the last week, but we started the first lecture with the full set of equations, okay? And I've asked you to write these full sets of equations every night before you go to bed. How many of you have been doing that? Anybody? Okay? All right, so let's remember that. Actually, Professor Kangalaris, when he teaches this course, every day comes in, the first thing before he starts the lecture, writes these equations in some corner of the blackboard. Just to emphasize that this is what you really are slowly learning. Okay, so what are they? Divergence of E. Let's write it in terms of D. The first time we wrote it in terms of E's and B's only. Okay? But let's write it in a slightly different form. We already know that divergence of D is equal to?
Rho.
Now, you guys forgot about it, but there is a divergence of B that happens to be?
Zero.
Yeah, so let's write that down too. And then there is curl of E, which in our electrostatic days, which is now, is equal to zero. But in the more dynamic situation, it is minus dBdt. That comes from my t-shirt, yes. My t-shirt designer knew all about that. All right, so, and the last equation was, what was that? That was curl of B is equal to mu naught times J plus mu naught times epsilon naught times dd dt. Okay, I'm gonna write it in a slightly different fashion, okay? I'm gonna take that mu naught that was multiplying J and put it underneath B and call B divided by mu naught by H. You guys remember your 312 material, yes. Curl of H, it turns out, okay? And on the other side, what used to be mu naught times J is now only this guy. As reminders here, we have D is a shorthand now, epsilon naught times E, but our H is a shorthand for B divided by mu naught, okay? So, and what else is left? Mu naught disappeared, therefore it should be epsilon naught times ddt of the electric field. But we can also write that as the ddt of the displacement. These are my four Maxwell's equations. The first week, I wrote it the way a physicist would write it. Right now, I wrote it the way electrical engineer writes it. Okay? Some physicists hate these, for instance, displacements. These, they think we shouldn't be even talking about them. But electrical engineers make use of them. Okay, so these are the equations, right? These are the Maxwell's equations. Now, the boundary condition equations. This has mnemonic detail or mnemonic value. Okay? Every time I see del, I'm going to replace it with the unit vector n hat. Okay? Every time I see a source, I will generate a surface source out of that. This guy, ladies and gentlemen, is the generic volumetric charge density. This is the volumetric current density. The current density that is measured as amperes per meter squared. The current density that populates a wire. If you cut the wire that is carrying some amperes, there is some amperes per meter squared. That is the current density J. Okay? Those are the sources of this, the explicit sources in these equations. Then there are these funny sources, time-dependent sources. Okay? So mnemonic correspondent as follows. Replace your dels with n's. Keep the dot or cross product. Apply it to now the same vector but in the difference form, d plus minus d minus. On the other side, take your source, which is in the main Maxwell's equation a volumetric rho. Replace it with the surface rho. Okay? That is this equation. I haven't proven it. Now I'm giving you the mnemonics. There is a proof that I can give, and I will. But we don't need the proof because we saw how this equation developed in our earlier work. Okay? Can you guys see the blackboard? I think some of you in the front can see. It's not so visible. Let me. This is a dot product. This is D plus. This is D minus. Second equation, you treat it the same way. N dot B plus minus B minus. But there is no source. There is no surface source either. There is no charge, magnetic charge of any type is equal to zero. Okay? And then now you interpret these equations. Normal component of D field will always jump by the available surface charge density, which means that it will not jump at all if there is no surface charge density. That only a surface charge density makes the normal component of D jump. Evidently, the normal component of B can never jump. That's a no-no. Okay? So we continue. Let me now handle this equation. Now, let me remind you that under static condition, curl of E is not equal minus dB dt, but it is curl of E simply is equal to zero. Or maybe another way of saying it, because in a static situation all the dt's are equal to zero, curl of E is equal to zero in statics. But the recipe continues. Replace your del with N. This time cross it into the difference. And now the difference that matters is the difference of electric field. And the other side is equal to zero. Okay? And now, can somebody help me with the last equation? Converting the last equation to the pertinent last boundary condition equation. Which is not something that we are using this week, but this is something that we'll be using, let's say, a week from now. Why don't you help me? What am I going to do? I'm going to replace the del with? What have I done? Every del that I have in original Maxwell's equations, I have replaced it on the other side by? And hat, why can't you answer me? You haven't been paying attention or what? You are writing down the equation but not paying attention. I wonder when you will pay attention. What will those equations tell you when you look at them? I think you are better off listening to me. Because, okay? Alright, so now, for your sake, what we have done in the first three equations is visit each one of Maxwell's equations. Replace every del with an n hat. Retain dot and cross products. Replace every source by the surface counterpart. Okay, we are continuing to do that. And that is going to lead, first, to N cross. You tell me.
H.
Go ahead. H. Look at what you have written before.
N cross H plus.
Yes.
Minus
H plus minus H minus. You're right. And what do I put on the other side? Wild guess. J? Not J. It's about something related to J. J? J sub S. J sub S. What the hell is J sub S? It's the surface current density. Okay? Something that we haven't seen yet. Okay? So if you take a wire that is carrying current, okay, that current is flowing all through the wire. So if you cut it, okay, and expose it, you should cut it in your mind, not cut it with actually, if you cut it because you stop the current flow. So that's bad. In your mind, you cut it. Then you imagine the surface area. That surface area is carrying amperes per meter squared. That is what we call volumetric current density, measuring in amperes per meter squared. But you may imagine the surface of a metallic plate that is carrying currents only by the motion of the charge on the surface of that metallic plate, but not the interior. That would be the surface current density. I'll give you another example for the surface current density. If you have a DC current going through a wire, you guys have learned in physics and everywhere else, maybe even high school, that current is going everywhere inside that wire. But do you remember what about AC current? AC current, is it the same or not? Is the current carried throughout the wire in the AC current or not? Do you guys remember this? it's all on the surface. You guys don't remember this. So you haven't known that? Okay, so it is the surface resistance that matters in AC calculation. This is something that we're going to see later in this class. Okay, I brought this up, just another example for you to visualize surface currents. Okay, you didn't know this fact, but you can visualize it. Okay, when you take a wire, connect an AC voltage source to a resistor, and then you complete the circuit. Current is going to flow in that circuit. Okay, but the current, of course, is now doing this because it's AC. And it's doing that on the surface and not in the interior. That just happens to be. Okay, so therefore, while volumetric current density is measured as amperes per meter square, the current that is flowing on a surface is going to be measured as amperes per, say, meter. Okay, so here's another picture. Gee, you know, I'm going in directions that I didn't know I was going to be going. Okay, so you may have a metallic plate, and there can be charges flowing just on this surface in this direction, constituting a, what I would call a J sub S, which is my surface current density. That is what I need to include here, okay? Do I need to add anything else to this?
What are the units for J? What are the units for J sub S?
I mean, this is what I've been telling you. J is in units of amperes per meter squared. The reason for this, and you shouldn't forget this, it's very easy. In a DC current situation, a wire that is carrying a current I equals 5 amperes, is evenly spread out.
Right,
throughout the wire. Therefore, you say, if I have 5 amperes and my surface area is 1 millimeter square, I have 1 ampere per millimeter square of J. That's, therefore, J is amperes per length square. In MPS, okay? So, by the way, I sent you guys a paper this weekend, right? Did you guys read it? Okay,
read it
this week. Okay, so that is I. I is in amperes, J is amperes per meter squared, and JS, which is just about, I was just about to show it with a picture, is amperes per meter. The reason, here comes, okay? So suppose that this is a funny sort of a surface to complete the circuit, Brian, in a circuit. Okay, so a current will flow through this guy. Okay, somehow for whatever reason, you're being told that the current is only flowing on the top surface if there is a thickness to it. Or you can imagine some sort of a hypothetical surface where there is no distinction between top and bottom, just the surface. This surface is conducting electricity, there is a current, and the current is 5 amperes. So I have I equals 5 amperes here. Okay? And let's say that this 5 amperes is flowing because there are charges moving uniformly all across. So what is the current density? 5 amperes per meter. The width of this. Let's say this is 2 meters. Then the current density is 5 amperes divided by 2 meters, 2.5 amperes per meter. Okay? So the units of current there, to summarize, just the current, amperes. Current density, J, amperes per meter square. Current density, surface current density, amperes per meter. Okay, so I am done. Okay, what did we do? We replace all the delts with n hats. We replace all the fields by their field differences on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, we killed all the fields. And we replace all the sources
with
their surface counterparts. Okay? Out of these four equations, now if you can remember this, you can always remember that, because you will remember this lecture. And we're making a clown out of myself to make this the remembered thing for you, okay? So Maxwell's equation, if you remember, you will remember the boundary conditions. For those, these are uniform and always useful. They are also the same in static situations. So we will solve some static problems with boundary conditions tomorrow. Okay, thank you.